everybody, and welcome to the Internet Storm Center podcast. This is a special presentation of all the speeches that were given by the handlers at SANS 2009. This next presentation is actually entitled Using Passive DNS Data to Track Malicious Activity. This presentation was provided by Bohan, actually remotely. He could not make it to Baltimore, so he was able to present his presentation from Croatia. Enjoy.
So first of all, thanks to all of you coming to listen to my presentation today. Unfortunately, I wasn't able to make it to Baltimore, but thanks to SANS, I'm able to give this presentation over internet. So it's 2 a.m. here in Croatia at the moment, but I'm not tired at all because I'm really excited about this presentation, and I hope that it will be interesting to you as well. So just a little bit information about myself for those of you who don't read or visit the Internet Storm Center regularly. My name is Bojan Ždrnja. That's my surname for those of you who didn't know how to pronounce it correctly, and I'm pretty sure you still don't know how to pronounce it again. I'm currently living in Croatia in Europe, and I work as a senior information security consultant in a small information security company called Infigo. In my spare time, I'm obviously doing some work as an Internet Storm Center handler. My main interests include, obviously, DNS, but also malware research and reverse engineering, and, of course, security in general. So let's go with the presentation today. This is the agenda. So first I will talk a little bit about DNS data replication in general, what it is and why we actually would like to do that in the first place. Then I will show what the DNS Parse project is. It's a project I've been working on for the last 3 years, and I think it turned out to be a pretty exciting resource that's available to security researchers around the world, and will be available to all of you participating today as well. I will explain which implementation issues I experienced and what I did to circumvent them. And finally, we'll look at some data that's available in the database at the moment and how some new research is actually making use of this data. And of course, I'll talk a little bit about future development and how all of you can actually get involved with the project as well. So why do we need DNS data replication in the first place? As all of you, I'm sure, know, DNS is a critical part of the internet. I would dare to say all applications today need DNS to function properly. Obviously, we can establish IP communication just by knowing two IP addresses, but for our users, DNS is actually a critical part of their everyday internet life. I usually say to network guys that I work with that they're always worried about network links, and if those links are down, they're obviously running around and trying to fix them. But for an end user, if there is no DNS, it's usually equals to no internet or no network for them, because that's what they need for internet to function. As all of you also probably know, DNS is a distributed system. It was built to allow high availability, which is obviously critical for such a critical part of the internet in the first place. So it's distributed, meaning that each server is responsible only for its own. It's basically a variable depth tree. It starts with the root server and then goes below to various country domains and so on. We all know about it. What's important about DNS is that there is basically no way to retrieve a whole zone. We can retrieve it from an incorrectly configured server, and that's something I will talk about in a second. But other than that, there is no way to retrieve the whole zone. And obviously, there is no way for anyone to retrieve the whole internet DNS structure. Some other things that are important for us when we look at DNS data replication are specifics about DNS. First of all, DNS allows multiple mappings. Multiple mappings are really common today. So for our multiple web mappings, when we have multiple websites hosting one IP address, are really, really common. This is used by web hosters, for example, when they want to have more than one website on a single IP address, because as we know, IP addresses are limited. We can't have unlimited number of IP addresses, at least not with IP version 4. With IP version 6, we have much more IP addresses, but still it's not limited, obviously. So that's one of the things we need DNS for, to allow multiple mappings. Multiple mappings can exist in reverse resource records as well, but these are actually very, very rare. I can't say that I even remember when was the last time I saw properly configured multiple mappings. The main reason for this is because an end user may control the DNS zone, and he can add any entries to the DNS zone he wants. But the IP address is usually owned by the ISP, and obviously the ISP cannot know what multiple records the user configured to one IP address. So that's why they don't get updated. And as the system is distributed, there is no way for this to be automated anytime soon, unfortunately. And the most important thing is that the history of any DNS changes is permanently lost when the DNS entries change. The whole system keeps absolutely no information about previous records. So once you change records in a zone that you have authority over, there is no history about that zone ever kept, unless we have a system such as the DNS parse, which I will show in a couple of minutes. So only the owner knows what actually happened to his zone, and that's also sometimes because if the DNS server gets hacked, then not even the owner knows what happened with it. So how do we implement DNS monitoring? There are a couple of ways that we can actually monitor DNS domain names and zones that we're interested in. Obviously, we can periodically just poll the DNS servers. If we want to, for example, monitor the www.sans.org domain, you can just set up a script which will send a DNS request for this domain name every 1 minute and then store the result into a file. And we can actually monitor what's going on with www.sans.org. The downside is that this is obviously intrusive. If you want to monitor, for example, 1 million domains, then we will utilize quite a bit of bandwidth, and that's actually not the best way to implement DNS monitoring, obviously. Of course, we have to know what we're looking for in advance, because we have to set the DNS name that we are actually requesting information about. This method is useful for malicious domains, because in some cases we actually do know which domains we want to monitor, and that's actually something that I implemented in the background of the DNS parse project as well. So some domains get queried all the time because we want to populate the data about those domains. The other way is actually to perform zone transfers, but obviously if a DNS server is properly configured, we have to get a consent of the DNS service administrator, because normally the DNS server should let us download the whole zone. That's actually a big no-no in security. Another approach is to modify client DNS resolvers. While this is theoretically possible, it's not really recommended way of doing DNS monitoring, because it's very intrusive, meaning we have to monitor the DNS, we have to modify the DNS clients, DNS resolvers on all client machines in enterprise, for example, and this is really impractical in most environments. Not only to say that some operating systems such as Windows will not allow you to modify such a core feature of the operating system easily, so that's really impractical. We could modify server DNS resolvers. This is actually much easier, because normally in an enterprise we're talking about a single or maybe a couple of DNS servers, main DNS servers for the whole enterprise. So it might be much easier to modify the DNS resolver software instead of client resolvers. One downside of this approach is that while we can log all the DNS queries and responses going through those DNS servers, we will not see any other DNS queries which are not directed to our official DNS servers. Now, in an organization, that's maybe not a problem, but for home users, it is a problem because there is a certain family of malware which is very, very popular today, and it's called DNS Changer. Some of you probably heard about it. This particular type of malware just modifies the DNS server settings on infected client machines, which means that if we modify the DNS software on our servers, on our official servers, we will not see these requests because they will go directly to a certain bad network, which you can see in the last line of this slide. So while modifying the DNS servers is sometimes a good approach, it will not allow us to monitor all DNS requests and responses that we might want to see. So finally, we get to passive DNS replication, and that's what this presentation is all about. As you can see, it's non-intrusive, obviously, because we're just monitoring network traffic. We do not insert any network traffic. We just monitor what we're seeing on the wire. And this approach allows us to see all DNS queries and responses, even those that go to this really, really bad network, 85.255. I'm pretty sure at least some of you heard about it. So when we talk about passive DNS replication systems, the first such project was started by Florian Weimer when he was still working at the University of Stuttgart in Europe. It has very similar architecture to DNS Parse, to the project I worked on. Actually, a lot of ideas I borrowed from Florian's paper, which was published in 2005. That is probably one of the first papers about passive DNS replication. At all. So about Florian's implementation, it also consists of a sensor and collector code. The sensor code is publicly available. You can download it from the website from the link that you can see on the slide, and it's written in C. However, the collector is not publicly available. You can get it on request. Florian will happily send the source to you. But the downside I found there was that it was written in ADA. And that's not actually language I was really familiar with. It was actually a complete unknown to me at the time I wanted to implement this. So I decided to roll on my own project. Florian's passive DNS replication system is publicly available at the URL you can see on slide. However, only limited amount of data is available through the web interface. I think only about last couple of weeks of the data he collects are available through the web interface because he wanted the queries to be as fast as possible, and there are no timestamps either, which is something that DNS Parse will provide you with. So the DNS Parse project was started back in 2006 at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. I lived in New Zealand back then. I moved back to Croatia last year. So initially, the project was started as just one of my postgraduate papers, and it turned out to be really, really interesting. That's why I continued working on the project. Maybe one day it will even be something bigger, meaning maybe I can do a PhD on that, but that's not the project goal, obviously. It is a goal for me, though. So the project goals were actually relatively simple. We wanted to collect authoristic DNS responses, seen in network traffic at the University of Auckland. The University of Auckland is a relatively big university, about 40,000 students and about 6,000 staff. So those 46,000 users generate quite a bit of network traffic each day. We wanted to import all the data into a database so we could do some data mining on collect the data, and one of the major goals was to build a sensor collector architecture which is simple and which would allow other users to implement their own sensors as simple as possible. And I think that we actually managed to fulfill some of those goals. So currently, the project has been running for 3 years, and we have 15 sensors spread around the world. Some of them are in big organizations. Some of them are in smaller organizations. There is one center which is run by the Internet Fund Center as well. One of my colleague handlers, Robert, is doing some really cool malware research, and she collects a lot of DNS data as well, and then we push all the data into DNS parse too. So it's available to other security researchers around the world as well. This is what the DNS parse web interface looks like. The URL is available on the screen. At the moment, it's protected with username and password credentials, as you can see on the screen. This isn't anything really particularly secret. It's just that this phase, which is still considered to be a beta phase, I didn't want Google or other search engines to crawl to the website and have millions of users visiting the website. So feel free to share this with your colleagues or other security researchers. As I said, this isn't anything particularly secret, but I still don't want to publish it in Google yet, because the system is still running on only one server, and maybe it's not well suited to just work under huge loads. This is the architecture of the system that we used initially at the University of Auckland. As you can see, it's very, very simple. There is the main server, which is the collector and database. It's all implemented on physically one server. The DMZ network at the university has a core switch, which through which all internet traffic to and from the university goes. And we just connected another server, which is running the Fenzer utility, to a span port on that switch. As you will see later, the sensor utility is actually relatively simple. It just monitors all the traffic and then regularly pushes the data to the collector, which is inside the main network of the university. One disadvantage here is, which you can maybe notice, is that as our sensor is connected only to the core switch, we are able to observe only DNS requests and responses that go to or come from the internet. This means that if there are some internal DNS servers at the University of Auckland, we actually don't monitor their traffic. That's because the traffic will just happen internally in the course, which we'll never see it. We decided this is good enough, at least for the data we needed when we initially implemented it. So let's see how the sensor works. As I said, I wanted to make the whole project as simple as possible, especially for the sensor operators, because I don't want to have them install dozens of different utilities just to get the sensor up and working. So the sensor actually consists of a special utility that I will talk about in a second, and it uses TCP dump to collect the data. TCP dump is, I'm sure all of you know, a very popular tool that allows us to log network traffic and inspect it. So in this particular instance of DNS parse, we are interested only in authoritative DNS responses. That means if we want to collect DNS traffic which has a bit set, and in order to allow that, we use a relatively simple TCP dump filter, which you can see at the bottom of the slide. So we collect UDP traffic on port 53, and then we check if the 10th bytes of the UDP packet has the 4-bit set to 1, which is AA. Obviously, this has a couple of disadvantages in the current version. First of all, we don't successfully monitor extended DNS responses. Extended DNS responses allow the DNS clients and servers to have multiple UDP packets for really big DNS responses. Our current implementation will collect only the first packet, because that's the only packet which will have the AA bit set. The other packets will just contain the data, so the current implementation will not collect them. We will not collect any DNS on transfers, because they normally go over TCP port 53. But this proved to be good enough for the current phase. So TCP RAM creates a PKET file on the sensor. It's just a binary file with all UDP port 63 traffic logged. There is a special sensor utility that was written in C, and that utility parses the PKET file. It actually does quite a bit of work, and again, as I said, I wanted it to be as simple as possible. I wanted the output to be as readable as possible. So what does the sensor utility do? It, first of all, eliminates duplicates. When we collect traffic for about, let's say, 1 hour, that's a typical schedule that we have on sensors. When we collect the network traffic for 1 hour, we normally see a lot of duplicates. There are, for example, probably like hundreds of DNS queries going to www.cnn.com. All of them have same responses because probably in that 1 hour, this particular resource records didn't change. So for all the records which are same, the sensor utility will properly update the structure that it keeps internally, which has two timestamps. First timestamp is when the particular resource record was first seen and when it was last seen. So if it's the same, it will just update the appropriate timestamps. Obviously, if the record changes or if it receives a different response, it will create another structure. Then once it parses the whole PKET file, the sensor utility will create a text output file so it can easily be inspected by sensor operators. I wanted to allow this to any operators so you can grab out any entries that you don't want to be pushed to the database. So it's really, really easy for a sensor operator to, you know, see what's actually coming from his network and going into the DNS parse collector. And finally, we use SCP, SSH to copy the file to the collector. This is really simple and secure. We normally rotate it every hour, unless it's a really, really busy sensor, in which case we might want to rotate it every 30 minutes or even more often if needed. So far, the biggest networks that we have sensors on just rotates PKET files every hour. That's proved to be enough. So the collector has another piece of software written for it. It's in C again with a couple of Perl scripts. It collects all these text files from sensors and it imports the data into the database. Currently, the project uses a MySQL database. You can use any database you want, but I actually wanted to use open source software just so it can be easily implemented absolutely everywhere. The whole package, by the way, is open source. It hasn't been really released, but if you want to implement this at your organization, you are feel free, obviously, to contact me and I can send the source and everything to you. There are a couple of organizations which use this internally already. So the sensor is actually relatively simple. It just takes the data it receives from sensors and pushes it into the database. However, when I initially did this, I found I experienced some issues with the database speed due to amount of data that we're actually collecting. So the whole database is really huge. We can expect to have hundreds of millions of records in the database in total, and we have large sets that we're importing every hour. Sometimes, for example, we had some of our networks where sensors have been deployed, we had them under some certain types of attacks, so they generated millions and millions of DNS queries in every hour, and it was all logged by the sensor and pushed to the database. So we can actually expect to have a couple of millions of records pushed into the database every hour. But that's not the only problem. The problem that I experienced was that we needed to search the whole database. When a security researcher wants to see a history of a certain record, obviously he wants to check the whole database or at least a part of the database. And that is a relatively expensive operation. So after some consultation with various database experts I talked to, I actually found out that I'm having some non-standard requirements. I have import process, which must be really fast, and that's obviously a write operation. And we have a read operation, which is data search, and it mustn't take too long because no one will use it if it takes half an hour to get some information back to you. So this actually proved out to be a non-trivial problem, and I have to thank Johannes here for helping me quite a bit with this, as he had a lot of experience with B-Shield, which we should all be at least a little bit familiar with. And B-Shield is obviously a really large database as well. So he gave me some tricks about how to implement all this properly. So the solution was to build a specific database schema that I will explain in a second. It's a little bit technical, but I think it's relatively interesting. And while I was talking to some other security researchers who had similar problems, it was interesting to see how we all actually ended up using very, very similar solutions. So the solution here was to build a special table that was used only for importing the data, and to have other special tables which are used for long-time storage and retrieval. And to offload some juggling of the data to the application. Because in time I found out that just using the database SQL statements to handle this amount of data wasn't really the best solution. So you can see the table description here, and this is what we actually store in the DNS part database. Obviously the query and the response from the DNS records that we monitored. We also log the resource record type, the TTL we saw, time to live, first seen and last seen timestamps, and we also log the sensor ID. The sensor ID is particularly interesting because initially I saw that we will see some geographic differences, but in time it showed up that all the sensors basically see the same data. But still, it's interesting to see some of the information related to the geographic location of the sensor. So the idea was to build a table hierarchy which is used for long-term storage of data. The system currently builds weekly tables, which are this format, like year and then week. So the first ever table to be written into the system was 2006-20. That was the 20th week of 2006, and that was when we started logging the data. These tables allow importing of historical data as well, and that's one really, really cool feature. About a couple of weeks ago, a security researcher on one of the closed mailing lists just emailed me and said, look, I've been using DNS parse for quite some time, and I like the system quite a bit. And I have some historical data going all the way back to January of 2007. So would it be possible to import this? And the cool thing was, because of the structure of the database, we can easily import historical data without worrying what will happen with the database. It's just a really, really simple process. So those weekly tables are heavily indexed, and that allows them, really fast search queries to go through all those tables. And then there is a special table which is called current, and this is the table which is used for when we import the data into the system. This table is specific in the way that it allows duplicates, which means that the database will not perform any checks when writing new data into the database, except if the data is correct, obviously. This allows the import process to be extremely fast, so we can write millions of rows into the database in a matter of dozens of seconds. So it's really, really fast. The problem with this table is that it is not indexed. So if you have to search for this table, every search basically goes through the whole table. That's why we want to keep the current table as small as possible. Finally, there is the master table, which just lists all the tables so the system knows where to search for the data. So the import process actually reads the data retrieved from the sensors and pushes that into the current table. This process is really, really fast, as I said, because the current table is not indexed, and it allows duplicates as well. And then every 8 hours, we actually migrate the data from the current table into those weekly tables. This is why we can actually import historical data as well. We can just push whatever we want. Something here changed. Just a second. Okay. So this is why we can actually migrate data quickly. There's external utility, which is ran every 8 hours, obviously, and it handles the duplicates in the current table. So we don't have to rely on the database to do that. And finally, we can rebuild images from these modified tables whenever we import the new data. So every 8 hours, if we modify any of the tables, of the weekly tables, we can just rebuild indexes on that table. So we can make sure that future search queries will be fast as well. So this is what we have today. When I created this presentation about 10 days ago, the database contained 863 million rows. So that's quite a bit. We're getting close to 1 billion, and I'm pretty excited about it because we just plain cool to have a database which has 1 billion rows. It takes around 650 gigabytes of disk, so that's not too bad. Indexing takes maybe about 400 gigabytes of disk, and 250 gigabytes is taken by the plain data. It's all ran on a single machine with two CPUs and 3 gigs of RAM, so it's nothing really too big. It handles the web interface too. So this is what the database size looked like during time. There is something relatively interesting here, and when we initially set up the project, we actually thought that the database size will rise exponentially, but as you can see, it's just a linear graph at the beginning. Then when we started adding more sensors, it just changed, and now it's a little bit linear as well. So it'll be interesting to see what will happen in the future, especially if we manage to get more sensors deployed around the world. These are just some statistics about the data in the database. I won't spend too much time here because the most interesting part is about data mining and actually how it can help us detect some malicious or bad domains. But you can see here that about 56% of data is just A or address resource record types. There are about 22% of reverse pointers and only 0.026 AAA records, which means that IP version 6 isn't really all that widespread, or at least we're not seeing that. So now let's get to the really interesting part, and that's about mining the data. So first of all, one thing that that actually puzzled me was that we didn't see absolutely any data locality. I was actually initially thinking that as most of the people visit more or less the same sites, that we will see some exponential rise of the database, as you said, and that it will, you know, get linear or slower. But unfortunately, thanks to spammers and malware and all other bad guys on the internet, all sensors constantly send absolutely new data. And we see a linear rise of new domains from absolutely every single sensor that you have around the world, especially except the one that Robert runs because it's a special one and it's used for research. One of the things that's interesting here, which I said previously and related to the fact that we log the sensor which sends a particular entry, is that we can get interesting domains related to the geographic location of the sensor. What's even more interesting is that, for example, if we see a particular dead domain, we can see what part of the world that domain was used first, and that can help us actually pinpoint or locate where the malware author lives. For example, if we know that a particular domain was first seen in Europe, it's obvious that at least the malware author was testing the domain in Europe. It doesn't mean that he's in Europe. Obviously, he can just use a hack machine in Europe. But this can help us actually see from where the things are coming. The database contains millions of type of squatting domains. Unfortunately, these are really, really common today. As you all probably know, you can see them in various phishing attacks or simply in marketing. There are loads and loads of type of scoping domains which are just related to some gray or shady marketing, really. In some cases, you can spot them automatically. It's actually not that easy. There is a project by Microsoft Research called Strider. Some of you maybe heard about it. And what they're trying to do with Strider is to automatically identify type of scoring domains. And that's something that a couple of researchers at the University of Auckland are looking at to integrate with DNS parse. So we can maybe spot these automatically. Some of them can be really dangerous, like the one that you can see on the screen at the moment. I hope this is big enough so everyone can read it. So this particular domain is a wildcard domain, and it was set up against the University of Auckland in New Zealand. So I found it particularly interesting as it came rather early during the implementation of the project. So as you can see here, the wildcard domain just points to auckland.ac.nz. There is a C missing there because Auckland is spelled A-U-C-K-L-A-N-D. And what the attackers did here is they just set up a wildcard domain and they tried to lure our students and staff into listing their own domain. Now, this is bad because, first of all, the domain namespace in New Zealand isn't really governed properly, so anyone can go and buy an ac.nz domain, which should be actually reserved only to academic circles, but they can do it as well. Luckily for us, they didn't do anything bad here. They were just doing some kind of, let's say, marketing and maybe click-based programs. There was no malware involved. There was no phishing attempt, but they could have been really, really bad. If you just go one slide back, you can see a couple of domains here that are potentially relatively sensitive, like www.health, auckland.ac.nz, or webmail2.ec, auckland.ac.nz, which is the webmail system used by the students at the university. You can also see the first one, which is just me testing something. So we can also see here the history of this particular record. We can see that they were moving through the world. The first one, unfortunately, this was originally intended to be a dynamic slide, which didn't transfer properly into Illuminate. But the first IP address here was located in the United States, in Texas. And then after some time, that was back in May 2006. And then in December 2006, they actually migrated to one ISP in New Zealand and then to another ISP in New Zealand and so on. So you can see that they are pretty steadily migrating IPs, probably as abuse services just shut them down or for whatever other reasons. So more type of squatting. One of the characteristics of type of squatting hosts today is normally there's a high number of virtual hosts. This is obviously not a definite sign because normal web hosters will have high numbers of virtual hosts just mapped to one particular IP address. But it's something that we can use in certain algorithms to detect things automatically. As you will see in a couple of minutes, this is what we can use when detecting fast flux domains, which are usually today related to malware. So the fast flux domains, I'm pretty sure that all of you are at least basically familiar with fast flux domains, but just to go through that quickly. So basically today we have single flux or double flux domains. Single flux domains just rotate or change IP addresses mapped to certain domain name. Double flux domains do the same thing with name server or NS records. Why do the bad guys do that? Because it makes it much, much more difficult to actually shut down their bad websites if they're using fast flux domains. However, they have some obvious benefits for the bad guys, but they have some characteristics that allow us to automatically detect fast flux domains as well. First of all, the TTL is a giveaway. They have to set the TTL field to a low value because they do not want the end client DNS servers to cache these values for a long time. Obviously, if they want to quickly migrate their resource records, the TTL has to be low. Normally, the TTL value is usually about 600 seconds or 10 minutes, and with fast flag domains, we can see various lower values, even zero, which basically means do not cache at all. So the current work that is used by a couple of security researchers is to use a linear classifier. It basically just calculates a flag score, and it's a function of three particular things: a number of unique A records, the TTL values, and unique ASNs. So for if you have a certain domain name and we see that it has 20 A records met to the domain name, and they have TTL values of 10 seconds, and they're all in unique ASNs spread around the world, that's a pretty good sign that we are dealing with a fast flag domain, which is probably not legitimate. There are a couple of projects that are working on this data, and they're trying to automate detection of fast flag domains. So this is one really historic example of a fast flag domain, which was used by the Stormworm. The tibeam.com domain was, I think, if I remember correctly, one of the first domains used by the Stormworm. And you can see here exactly what I was talking about. We have hundreds and hundreds of IP addresses assigned to the domain. The TTL is zero, which means do not cache. And we have a really high number of ASNs. And that's a really good signature of a fast flag domain. However, some other domains are not malicious, and they share quite a bit of similar characteristics with such fast flag domains. The one shown here has a TTL of 300, which is 5 minutes. It's not too bad. It also has hundreds of IP addresses, but we can see here that at least some of the IP addresses share similar ASNs. This particular name is www.microsoft.com, which is hosted at Akamai, a content delivery network. And CDN providers normally use some features similar to FastFlux just to make sure that they're having resilient service and which is available throughout the world. So when you want to automatically detect FastFlux domains, we usually want to at least have a whitelist of legitimate websites, so we want to eliminate those and not to create false positive alerts, obviously. Besides fast flag domains, we can also, in some cases, detect phishing domains. Depending on the phishing kit, the detection of some of such domains is really, really simple. You can see on the slide just a small excerpt of the phishing pages against www.paypal.com. This is actually very common, and I'm sure that you've seen similar URLs previously as well. What they do is that they create a unique domain name. They use sometimes even compromised domains. And then they create a couple of subdomains, which starts with www.paypal.com. Obviously, the main intention here is just to fool the users who will think that they're actually going to www.paypal.com, and they will not recognize it. This is all part of the one domain name. This is really straightforward to detect, and the alerting system that DNS Parse allows at the moment will actually allow you to will actually automatically alert about such phishing attacks. Finally, one of the things that is not implemented yet, but I would really like to get it in place as soon as possible, is to implement record replication. The idea here is to add another column which will allow us to collect data from some other sources, like for example, CVX inbox or Barsatel and so on, which automatically analyze malware, and we can then, depending on the domain names that the malware visits, we can automatically assign certain values to reputation of domain names that were used by the malware. What's interesting here is that in some cases we can correlate this with new domains, and the system can maybe proactively alert us when a new domain name has been detected, which might be malicious. This particular example shows some malicious domains which all share one single name server. That name server doesn't host any legitimate domains, so the system can automatically alert when a new domain has been seen and when it uses the same name server. So to wrap this up slowly, just a slide about future development and how maybe you can also get involved in the project. First of all, I plan to add new interfaces. As security researchers worked with the data in the database, they actually wanted some easier interfaces. At the moment, as you saw, it's a web-based interface, which can be scripted relatively easy, but the idea is to give another interface such as the DNS or WHOIS interface, which can be really easily scripted and called. Obviously, I would like to add more sensors, because the more sensors we have, the better the data in the database is, and this is where you can help. If there is a way for you to run a sensor, or if you want to participate in the project, obviously feel free to contact me. You all have access to the web page now, and as I said, it's nothing secret. Obviously, we want to add some advanced data mining processes, which would help us to automatically detect malicious domain names or phishing or spam domain names. The latest cooperation that I managed to get was with SURBL. That hasn't been implemented yet. It's really fresh, but we will be able to import the data from SURBL into DNS parse, which is really great, because they have a really huge database of current spam and malicious domain names. So I think it will be a really nice addition to the database. And finally, a couple of other things. Improved alerting. Alerting already works. You can go to the database, go to the web interface. There is a special page for setting up alerting. You can just enter any keyword you want, and the system will alert you automatically when a new domain name has been found, which matches your keyword. The system is actually relatively smart here. When a domain name has been detected, which matches your keyword, the system will check the whole database to see if that particular domain name has been seen previously. If it has, then the system will not send an alert, obviously. If it hasn't, it will send an alert email. It will also send you an alert email if the domain name resource record changed, which is interesting to see if there is if someone is trying to perform some kind of attacks. This is really good for phishing domains as well, or for any trademark names that you might want to look at. Obviously, I want to improve database searching. We still can't afford to search with regular expressions, because it just is too expensive in a database. It takes tens of minutes, if not hours, if you want to search, for example, for, I don't know, star, that takes like 20 minutes to get back. And we want to allow searching by networks or network neighbors or IP addresses and so on. And finally, I would like to add support for secure DNS, as we don't have that at the moment. And that's basically the end of the presentation. I would like to thank you all. David told me that if there are any questions, he will type them in the text chat for me, so I can read it and I can answer. Again, thanks everyone for listening to me. I'm sorry I couldn't be in Baltimore, but I hope that the presentation was at least interesting. Okay, there's a question about requirements for participation. Basically, it's just a server that can see your network traffic. The server requirements are really low. Our sensors are running on small old boxes. It doesn't require, you know, a big grumpy server at all. You don't have to have a really busy network because every data we receive helps. So it's actually, the requirements are almost nothing. I mean, you do have to have a server, obviously, that you will run the sensor code on. But some people run it on their DNS servers. So it doesn't have to be a separate box. As I said, it's just a PCP down process, which runs, and then every hour a sensor utility runs for maybe half a minute to collect the data and push it over SCP to the collector. Okay, a question about aging of the data. At the moment, no. I actually would like people to be able to search through the whole database, no matter how old the data is. However, I want to improve the searching interface, so if you're not interested in data from 2006, you can just tell the system, look, I only want to see last 2 weeks. That's actually one of the things that might allow us to make better search queries, for example, to allow regular expressions and so, because if we only have to go through last couple of weeks of data, it can be relatively fast. To support larger databases, well, at the moment, it suits our needs, and MySQL proved to be a relatively good database for this type of data. I plan to add support for some other databases as well, just so people can use them if they want to. Okay, so about higher education. Well, in higher education, basically, it's simpler because the business requirements for data privacy maybe aren't all that strict. We had quite a bit of questions coming from people about data privacy, because in some cases, for example, you don't want the whole world to see that your site went to a certain domain name, which will obviously be visible if there is a sensor and if we know that the sensor is running at that particular university, for example. Just to give you an example of this, let's say a porn site. We won't know who visited the site, but we will know that there was at least one person or a process at that university that visited the website. So we had actually more problems with the privacy of data than with implementation challenges with maybe centralization or decentralization of data. I think that the privacy of data is probably the biggest obstacle. Although we don't really log, the system doesn't log any details about who requested the certain domain name to be resolved. Obviously, when the TCP dump process runs, it will log packets which will contain IP addresses, and depending where the sensor is, if someone looks at the traffic, that person can see which client machine, for example, try to resolve a certain domain name. But once the sensor utility processes that file, that information is permanently lost. All we collect is just the DNS request and what the response was. So yeah, we had more issues with privacy, actually. Okay, well, thanks again. As I said, I hope it was interesting for everyone. And if you have any other questions, obviously feel free to contact me or use the contact form on the FENS Intern Storm Center website.